The following program is a presentation of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
Did you know that tons and tons of Mexican silver has arrived in South Texas over the past 200 years? And most of it heads straight to the refiner for recycling, except... Good morning, everyone. Welcome to In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? I'm David Bluestein.
And I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio.
We're here each Saturday morning at 7 o'clock to provide an insider's view on the world of jewelry, coins, antiques, collectibles, and much, much more. As owners and operators of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, we're on the front line with a finger on the pulse of these markets every day, and as of right now, you have a friend in the business. Yeah, we and our fellow precious metal traders, we see tons and tons of Mexican silver in the form of jewelry and hollowware like bowls and trays and pitchers and various objects of art. And we send most of it straight to the refiner for recycling. You know, the fact is, with silver at over $30 an ounce, the high bidder for almost any piece of silver from almost any country, from almost any era, will probably be the refiner. We tell people all the time that we're going to melt something, and they say, oh, you can't melt that. We say, well, gee, do you want to buy it? Do you want to pay more than the refiner? And when they hear what the refiner's willing to pay, we say, no, this ain't no museum,
folks.
And
we're not the preserver of the arts.
Right, we're not the preserver of the art. We're not the museum. We're going to keep everything moving. You regular listeners know that we're flippers. We flip, flip, flip. And that means selling it to the refiner if the refiner's the high bidder. You know, away it goes. I mean, there are exceptions, but how do you know what the exceptions are? Today, our friend Ernie Martin is here to tell us all about Plata de Mexico, Mexican silver. And on our Insider Report, we'll be answering some FAQs, frequently asked questions that you need to know the answers to. To which you need to know the answers. There, you never end the sentence with a preposition. But first, what a week at the Jewelry Exchange. Adam?
Yeah, last week we sold about 32 pieces of Disney porcelain figurines, all with no reserve.
You know, it's such high-end porcelain, and they really do such a good job with it. If you didn't know better, you might think it's hard plastic, but it's just wonderfully finished and really beautiful porcelain in the form of Disney figurines.
And there seemed to be some genuine competition for it.
Sure.
We also sold 2 U.S. cents, copper cents, for a total of $3,000. A 1916D U.S. Mercury dime for $2,000.
Well, that's the dime.
That is the dime
of the Mercury
series.
That's
right. A 1799 draped bust silver dollar, $975.
Which is actually cheap for a draped bust dollar.
And an 1893S Morgan silver dollar, $5,300.
Yeah, the bidding started at $5,000, but two guys just drove it up to $5,300, and finally one of them dropped out. We said sold. That's an auction.
That's got about $28 worth of silver in it.
Yeah,
something
what
like
a buy.
That. Some ancient Roman coins with no reserve, over 1,000 years old. We sold an error, US $1 bill, and the seals and the serial numbers were printed on the wrong side. Rather interesting.
Third printing error.
We also sold a 2006 three-piece U.S. proof and uncirculated American Eagle 20th anniversary silver coin set, including the reverse proof variety. A bunch of James Avery at up to 80% off retail, including a lot of retired and hard-to-find pieces, authentic Tiffany jewelry with no reserves, loose diamonds with no reserves. Some of those went for as little as $80 a carat. And this week, we've got a bunch of Yadro, that's a collectible porcelain figurines, all new in the box with no reserve. Some Chilmark, which is a collectible pewter figurines. Some more of the Disney, a lot more coins. We've got handguns, Ruger 9mm, Berettas, a Glock 40 cal, Smith & Wesson.
These look brand new, too.
A lot of these I described as like new because... I was told that they were only fired once, and they look it.
And a Mosin Nagant. It's like we have a Mosin Nagant factory in the back of the gallery. It seems every week we have another Mosin
Nagant. We're not making our own.
We don't make our own.
And this week I've also got some more diamonds and loose diamonds, gemstones, new Tanzanite jewelry, more Tiffany, James Avery, Rolex. You can go to jewelryexchangeandauction.com to preview tonight's auction or even see the results of our last 30 auctions and come check it out tonight, 7 p.m.
Yeah, it's the real world of jewelry and coins and collectibles. We're not waiting for just the right buyer to come along. My question is always tonight at 7 o'clock, who will pay the most? Going, gone, sold, and we just move on from there. You've got to see it. If you haven't seen it, you can do it online. You can come do it in person. It costs nothing to come. You don't even have to register. Just come and watch. There's an off-duty uniformed police officer at the door. Everybody's happy. Come on up. 7 o'clock will start tonight, and we hope to see you all there. Let's do this week's In the Money Trivia Quiz, the quiz where you win the answer. First, let's review last week's quiz. It was a really simple quiz that almost nobody got right. How simple, though? Last week's quiz. I'm a United States coin, and I'm mostly copper. Well, obviously, that's the penny, right? And we got many, many emails from our listeners giving us that answer. I'm a United States coin, and I'm mostly copper. Must be a penny. I have a president on one side and a building on the other side. Well, again, must be a penny. Lincoln on the front, right? On the back, what's the building? The Lincoln Memorial. On the back of the coin, or as numismatists say, the reverse. And during World War I, I was made of silver. Well, that must refer to the 1943 silver penny that people call us about all day long that was produced to preserve copper. You know, copper makes up 95% of the brass or the bronze that's used to make pennies, or at least at the time it was, and it's used to make shell casings for the ammunition during World War II. So in 1943, the United States made a penny. A zinc-plated steel penny that people love to call the silver penny. The United States has never made a silver penny. It's a zinc-plated steel penny. That we're not referring to pennies. Everybody said, well, obviously that's the penny. Copper.
If you can pick it up with a magnet, it's not silver.
Well, right. It's a 1943 zinc-plated steel, and of course the steel is magnetic. Those pennies weren't silver. They were zinc-plated steel. However, there's another circulating United States coin that fits the clues to a T, and that's the Jefferson nickel. The answer to this week's quiz is the Jefferson nickel. Look, number one, I'm a United States coin, and I'm mostly copper. Well, how can a nickel be made out of copper? Believe it or not, the United States 5-cent piece, that's the official name of our 5-cent coin, the government doesn't call it, the mint doesn't call it, coin dealers and coin collectors don't call it nickel. It's a 5-cent piece. The United States 5-cent piece is 75% copper, 25% nickel. Nickel is such an aggressive metal color-wise. You mix 25% nickel with yellow gold, you get white gold through and through. Nickel, very aggressive. And the president on one side and a building on the other. Well, President Jefferson's on the front, and his family home, the Monticello, was on the reverse. And made out of silver during World War II, from some of the 1942s, but all of the 1943s, 4s, and 5s are 35% silver. The United States took that opportunity to save the copper, to make brass and bronze for shell casings for the war effort, and substituted some of the copper with silver because, I mean, isn't that strange? We had all the silver we could use, but we needed the copper to make shell casings. We did have some winners, though, and the first three correct respondents, Eden Crane, Moses Zappian, and Philip Sorolsky, the prize, a complete set of Jefferson nickels from 1938 to 1961, that's the Whitman folder number one for you people who are keeping score at home, including all 11 of the 35% silver World War II issues. If you're a winner, if I read your name, Eden, Moses, and Philip, please come up to the Jewelry Exchange and auction at 19903 Stone Oak Parkway within the next 30 days to claim your prize. We're open Monday through Saturday, 10 to 6, and of course Saturday evenings for our live auction. Come tonight, watch the auction, get your prize. And for more information, you can just hit the Contact Us tab on our website at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And now for this week's quiz, Adam.
And I'm just going to add to the war or nickels that people all the time ask me, is this one silver? That you can just flip it over. Look at the Monticello over the dome. If there's a big P, D, or S mint mark, then that one's 35% silver. If there's no P, D, or S mint mark, it is not 35%
silver. It's a big letter floating over the dome.
You can't miss it.
Don't see it? It's not silver.
Okay, this week, many countries have different purity standards for precious metal in coinage and jewelry. Now, this is a two-part question. What is the American purity standard for silver jewelry, and from what country did we adopt our standard? And it didn't really occur to me when I wrote this question what the topic was, but I hope that we don't answer it during our interview.
Well, we might. Why don't you all stay tuned with your Dick Tracy decoder rings, and maybe you can pluck the answer out of our discussion with Ernie Martin today.
So what is the purity, and at what, from what country did we adopt that standard? To be a winner this week, all you have to do is be the first person to email the correct answer to quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. You can also submit your answer directly from our homepage at www.inthemoneyradio.com. Then listen to next week's show and see if we read your name on the air. If we do, come claim your prize at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction at 19903 Stone Oak Parkway. Within the next 30 days, enter as often as you like, but please, only one winner per household per month. Remember, that email address is quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. That's quiz@inthemoneyradio.com, and good luck. And now let's take a short commercial break. We will be right back with more In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein. Hi, this is Adam from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio, introducing our weekday James Avery Auctions with 1,000 pieces of estate James Avery jewelry sold to the highest bidder with no minimums or reserves. New and retired designs at up to 80% off. This is a perfect opportunity to stock up on hard-to-find pieces. It's easy to register and bid online right now at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Auctions start every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evening at 7 o'clock. Also join us each Saturday at 7 p.m. for our live auctions in Stone Oak, featuring even more designer jewelry from Rolex, Tiffany, Pandora, John Hardy, David Yurman, and more, all guaranteed to be authentic. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Texas license number 16604, member Better Business Bureau. Visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com and join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLUP. James Avery is a registered trademark of James Avery Craftsman Incorporated.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it?
And this week I'm going to be talking about a request that I get all the time. You know, we sell an awful lot of new and estate jewelry at auction, and honestly, that is the best way to get jewelry, that you're going to get the best pieces for the least amount of money at auction.
Well, it's like buying a used car, right? Somebody else paid all that showroom upfront charge, and even though the car might be only 2-3 weeks old and look good as new, all of a sudden the price is 10-20-30% lower.
And we own a lot of it, and we're just willing to sell it for
And we're flippers, too. Yeah, we're not waiting for just the right person to come along.
But I get requests all the time for very specific new jewelry, and for some reason or another, they just can't buy it at auction. Maybe it must be new because it's a wedding set, and believe me, people do not want your old wedding sets. When I have a used wedding set, I almost always take it apart because you try to propose to a woman with a used wedding set, that's a big red flag.
Red flag.
Or it's just that they need something that's a style that we just don't have, and they're tired of waiting. They want to get it now. You don't have to have a jeweler make it for you. Pretty much anything you can think of, it's already made in a catalog. It's already being mass-produced. There's no reason to pay a jeweler to design it and make it from scratch for you. You can get new jewelry with your specifications at about 1/3 to 1/2 of retail. It's just not going to be as fancy as going to a retail jewelry store.
You mean the experience won't be as fancy?
The jewelry will be the same merchandise.
The same jewelry.
The experience won't be as fancy. We're not going to serve you wine, and there are no special lights. But I'm going to walk you through the process. First, go to a retail jewelry store. Find the style that you like. They're going to have a whole bunch of inventory, and you can take advantage of that. Try on all kinds of things and ask them questions and waste all their time. And
and take a picture of what you see that you like.
Exactly. Take a picture of what you see that you like, and even try to get a picture of the tag. All the numbers that don't mean anything to you on the tag, they can mean something to us.
They probably mean something to us.
And if you can get that picture and you find the style that you like, you should also get a price for comparison and for some laughs later. Once you know exactly what you want, the second step is to just to choose a gemstone and or diamond. And what you can do is go to, if you're looking for a diamond, go to our diamond inventory on our homepage at www.jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Right in the middle of the page, there's a diamond icon that says see our diamond inventory. Now on there, you're going to find some of our diamonds at the top of the list. You will also find about 800 other diamonds that I don't have in the gallery, but they're ones that belong to other dealers that we deal with that are in the vicinity, and we can have them sent in with no obligation pretty easily.
Yeah, nothing's more than 24, 48 hours away, and if you like it, great, and if you don't, we would just return it.
And I didn't put anything on there that I thought was overpriced. If it was just too much, I don't want to waste everybody's time.
Well, you know, that's the thing. We're offered merchandise all the time for the diamond inventory or for consignment at auction, and people tell us the minimum they're willing to accept for it, and if it's just not realistic, if it's just not a bargain, why should we waste our time and their time and your time? We'll just reject it. And these diamonds are from private individuals or from dealers, or even some of them are international diamond dealers with a direct conduit to an Israeli diamond cartel that does an end run around De Beers, and these guys just want to sell diamonds. They don't care about propping up world diamond market prices.
And you can get anything from very small diamonds all the way up to, I saw 5.5 carats on there. It's just a commodity that you can get all you want.
And you know what I find interesting too is that sometimes some of our customers say they've mentioned our diamond deals to other jewelers, and the jewelers say, well, no, their diamonds aren't the same as my diamonds. These diamonds on this list, almost without exception, are certified and graded by either GIA or EGL, the number one and number two grading certification services in the world. So it's not just what some guy at a mom and pop store said. It's not something we said to try to convince you should buy our diamond. These are the top two grading services in the world. And in fact, good chance that the diamond you're looking at the other place is the one that doesn't have very high certification and grading services behind it.
And the diamonds that we have on our inventory, we pretty much bought them over the counter. That we own those. They're there in the gallery. You come on in and take a look at them. There's certification or guarantees on all of them, really. Most of them aren't graded by us, but there are some that are graded by us. I'm going to give you some examples. There's I have a 1-carat oval cut diamond. It's F color, VVS1 clarity. The only grade higher than that is internally flawless. And that's not me saying that. That's GIA's grade.
Gemological Institute of America, the number one, the most trusted service in the world. Ask your jeweler. Google it. Number one service.
And our listed price, $6,895. I have a 1.52-carat round brilliant diamond, J color, VVS2 clarity, again, GIA certified, $9,689. If you can't spend that much money on a diamond, you're on a budget. I've got a 0.52-carat princess cut diamond, G color, I1 clarity. We graded that. I'm guaranteeing that's the grade. I have some GIA certification, and that diamond, $395.
Yeah, we've sold at auction 1-carat diamonds under $100 because the quality just wasn't there. So don't think that just because it's a big diamond, you have to pay a lot for it. I'm not telling you that a $99 1-carat diamond is a sight of beauty and a pleasure to behold, but it's there, and it does sparkle, and it's a real diamond, and everything we tell you about it will be true.
I have some diamonds that I'll sell you for a dollar. And sometimes I drop one on the ground and don't even bother to pick it up.
Come on in. We'll give you a diamond. It's a real diamond. We'll just give it to you.
But these are at or below real wholesale prices. We sell to dealers that pay the same price. I figure that a dollar from a dealer is the same as a dollar from the public. A dollar is a dollar.
Yeah, some of these guys say, you're ruining the diamond market. And we say, no, we're ruining your diamond market. Our market's just fine.
That's right.
We're flipping diamonds.
And so the bottom line is you do not have to pay retail. If you're looking for gemstones, you can buy them for next to nothing at the live auction. We sold a bunch last week. I've got a bunch more tonight in the auction. And if you can... We've got some fire opals, some rutilated quartz, aquamarines, and much more.
That's tonight with no reserve.
That's all tonight, reserve.
You know, everywhere you go, what signs do you see all over town? We buy gold. They're buying this merchandise. They're paying you nothing for the precious stones. They're melting the gold. What happens to the precious stones? Everybody I know in this business has bags and baggies and gem jars full of these stones. They paid nothing for them. They don't even know what to do with them. We put them in the auction. We sell them off. It's an opportunity for you. Real diamonds. I mean, yeah, real diamonds, real rubies, sapphires, emeralds, and the minor stones all the way down to amethyst and even CZs. I mean, you get a great deal on a CZ. A CZ that might cost you $100 at a jewelry store that you can get from us for next to nothing. You tell us at auction. You name your own price.
But don't pay hundreds of dollars for gemstones. I see people doing it all the time. You don't need to do that. A third, choose a setting. We use Stuller. It's a catalog company based out of Louisiana.
Well, it's the biggest in the southern United States, Stuller. Every independent jewelry store you go into has Stuller all over the place. And when they need some basic material, they're going to order it out of the Stuller catalog.
And again, from our homepage at www.jewelryexchangeandauction.com, right next to the diamond icon, there's another icon there that shows a ring, and it says, see our new jewelry inventory. We're not trying to be coy about it. That goes right to the Stuller catalog. You can go to that homepage, the Stuller homepage, and go shopping right there. You would need to choose a material, decide whether you want 10 karat gold, sterling silver. What color do you want it in?
I want to refer back to this week's quiz where I mentioned that nickel is a very aggressive metal. A little bit of nickel mixed in with another metal, and everything turns white. Do you know that the white gold that is so popular now that you see at all the jewelry stores is almost always rhodium-plated yellow gold? It's not white gold. It's yellow gold that has been plated with rhodium.
And the problem with that is that after about 6 months, the rhodium plate comes off, and now it's yellow again.
And you get to plate it all. Bring it back to the jeweler and pay him to plate that all over again.
What I'm getting at is that Stuller has a wonderful invention that they call X1, and that it's essentially the same price as the regular white gold. Only X1 is white through and through. I don't believe they actually alloy it with nickel. It's something else that's not going to irritate your skin. But it is white through and through. You don't have to worry about getting it rhodium plated constantly.
Well, it's really a return to the old days when white gold was alloyed to be white through and through. You cut an old white gold ring in half, and you see it white through and through, and none of this rhodium that just wears right off.
From the Stuller website, once you choose a material and choose your color, you can choose a style. They got about a zillion different designs there. You don't have to have something custom made. And Stuller is very flexible. You can find a design that will probably fit your gemstone, whatever center stone you chose, whether it was a diamond or a gemstone, whatever size, whatever cut. We can make it fit.
And it's not just that. A lot of these rings are in the old Art Deco style with concentric geometric designs with a lot of small diamonds. And, of course, you can get these settings with those small diamonds already set. Why pay an American jeweler $15, $25, $35 a piece to set those stones when you can get them already set from the manufacturer in China and India, where people are doing quality work and working for just a couple dollars a day? And when you get this merchandise, when it comes in, if you need to be more and more economical, you can shave the size of the slightly smaller stones, slightly lesser grade, until we're able to hit your price point for you.
But the bottom line is, once you find something you like there on the website, get the item number. give me a call, 592-8786, or visit our Stone Oak location, and I'll make you a price. We take our cost, the wholesale price, divide by 0.7, effectively adding only 30% to the sale price, while the retail jewelry stores are taking the same merchandise and doubling and tripling the wholesale price. We will have the piece overnighted to us. We will take it to the jeweler, have them put it together professionally. We don't set stones. You don't want us to set
them. You don't want us to set them.
No, that's right. And for a very small labor fee, they'll put it all together. We will deliver you the finished product in a nice box with all the certifications. All the pieces are new. You chose all the components, and it's still a small fraction of retail. That's what I did when I got married, and you can do it too.
Yeah, my experience, 40%, 60%. Off of the retail price. And, you know, like Adam said, some people like to go and get fussed over. But, you know, gentlemen, if you're getting married, I hope you have the kind of woman who says, you know, I'd rather not get fussed over. I'd rather save 40 to 60%.
Which is thousands of dollars.
And you can sit down with her, have a glass of wine, look online, look at the designs. Gentlemen, my advice to you, see to it that she's involved in the process.
Oh, yeah, get exactly what she wants,
get
or you're going to hear about it
for the rest of your life. That music means you're up against a hard break. KLUP is about to take you away, but we're not going anywhere. We're going to be right back with Ernie Martin to talk about the silver of Mexico. You're listening to In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. You're back with David and Adam Bluestein. Could remember my name for a second. David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our guest today, Ernie Martin, one of our favorite associates and a most colorful character. Welcome, Ernie. Thanks for joining us here on In the Money.
Thank you very much.
Ernie Martin, hardly a Mexican name. How is it that you're an authority on Mexican silver?
Well, I backed into it in the late 60s. At that time, I was masquerading as a hippie. And
I was going to say, I think you might have backed into a number of things in the late 60s.
No, not any girls. But the deal was that there were several things that were in the genre of being in the hippie thing. And one of them, let's put it this way, there was Western wear, shirts and boots mostly,
okay,
not so
sure.
much hats. There was also Hawaiian shirts, Bakelite jewelry,
right.
And silver jewelry from Mexico. And so I backed into it from that point of view as a lifestyle accoutrement.
And really. I think you were actually in San Francisco at that
time. I was in San Francisco.
But working in the financial district.
The interest in all of those four things that I mentioned came after I left the financial zone.
Yeah,
right?
All that, sure.
Yeah, I had to shed that uniform put on another one.
Yeah.
Include growing a mustache and the whole thing. So
these were the trappings of your new...
The trappings of a new lifestyle.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But it was a very vibrant culture. For instance, my accountant and his partner were selling false mustaches for people who came in from Santa Cruz and San Jose on the weekend, right?
Oh, man.
And so that was one of the things. The people who were interested in it, and there were many people who were interested in Mexican silver jewelry, didn't have any literature available. There was no information. Everything was word of mouth. And surprising to me, all of that information from the late 60s till today holds up under scrutiny. And research.
Information about
marks and
The different hallmarks on the back of the jewelry and what they meant and where they came from.
Yes, yes.
And which ones are better than other ones?
Well, that's always, you know, I mean, that's beginning to shake out, has begun to shake out considerably now. But in those days it was, and even up through the 80s, it was a matter of personal opinion. But now, money being what it is, as the common denominator, that tells you who's the better, right?
There's like a market now, and some are up
very,
and some are down.
Well, I wouldn't say any are down.
Okay.
Because what happens is that the thing has accelerated in terms of popularity. And so what happens is that as the front runners go up in price, and we're talking in the multi-thousands of dollars,
really?
Then people who are still interested kind of by default go into lesser makers who were not considered the big time in the beginning,
well,
or we're not, you know, we're not even considered at all.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation because, as you've reminded me in the past, essentially nobody in my business, including me, has any real understanding of this market.
That's right.
And so, look, let's start basically. Mexico has plenty of silver and they have plenty of gold, right?
Right.
And I mean, so do we here in the United States. And
right.
People take some of that and they make jewelry out of it and they sell it. How is that any different in Mexico?
Well, it's a matter of style, all right? And that's what the connoisseur of Mexican jewelry is interested in. He's interested in the style twist that the Mexicans put on that jewelry.
And is that significantly different than what we might consider Southwest American, Native American jewelry?
Very.
So it's not all the turquoise and the coral and all that stuff.
It has turquoise occasionally. And as a matter of fact, the Native Americans learned their early silversmithing from Mexican silversmiths or Mexican blacksmiths. Mm-hmm. And however, that has really little to do at all with the styles. The styles are distinctly different. The earlier styles of the Mexican silver jewelry,
Styles meaning what? Back to the conquistadors?
Well, you could go that far back, and in that case, you're dealing with things that come from Spain, come from the integration of the Arab culture, from Africa, and so forth. Those things went into the mestizo or Indian community, and so they wore a particular type of jewelry, right?
And that's a combination of a Spanish influence and a Native American influence.
Yes, a Native American, but that's not what we're addressing today.
Okay.
That's just one aspect that's out there in terms of Mexican silver and particularly Mexican gold. They love that gold.
Really?
But then, starting after the Revolution, the Mexican Revolution was around 1910 to 1920. Starting after the Mexican Revolution, there was a whole lot of fervor for Mexico, both, of course, in Mexico itself and also in the United States. So a tremendous amount of tourism developed in that period of time. Now, a lot of things came together, roads, et cetera, and communication. So as a result, there were early shots at developing what was known as tourist jewelry. And that would be the classic Mexican sleeping under the cactus with the donkey, right?
And really, and that's the era that we're talking.
We're talking that era from about 1920 to 1930.
And so these people that come into our gallery with books and they're flipping over all the jewelry and looking at the hallmarks and
They're not talking about this stuff from 1920 to 1930. Not yet, no.
Oh.
They're talking about some very simple, unsophisticated stuff that was manufactured, or not manufactured, that was hand-produced usually to sell to tourists who were coming into Mexico from 1920 to 1930.
Okay, and what did if you saw one in a shop someplace and didn't have an opportunity to touch it, how would you know that's what you're looking at? What style might it be?
How I would know would be by the design. A very simple...
A geometric shape? Or
No, just a very simple, funky Mexican look, all right?
You're going to have to translate for the South Texans here.
This is the problem with not having a picture here to show
you. Well, we're on the radio.
I understand. We're limited. But what we don't even want to get involved in that because it's not important. What is important is what happened starting in around 1931. And in 1931, we had basically a revolution in Mexican silver, a complete change as to what was being presented to the tourists who were coming down from the United States, from Europe, etc. And that difference was with William Spratling, who was an architect who came to Tosco from Louisiana, from New Orleans.
Now that name I've heard, Spratling Jewelry.
Right, and he's probably the apex of what you would hear in terms of producers.
And when we hear Spratling, they're referring specifically to the Mexican jewelry of this era.
When you hear Spratling, they're referring to Spratling Jewelry, which would be jewelry produced by Spratling.
Okay, and, but now, that's exclusively Mexican silver jewelry of this
absolutely.
Era.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not doesn't include anything German style,
no,
or Art
no,
Deco, or
no,
anything. It's
no,
this
no.
era of Mexican
no,
jewelry.
No, he came in and he did two very interesting, or two or three very interesting things. First thing he did was he started what's known as the workshop system. And this blended perfectly with the Mexican culture. He started this in Taxco, which had been a major source in the colonial times for Mexican raw silver.
And Taxco is a particular Mexican mine?
Taxco is it's the Santa, the church of Santa Prisa. I don't know the name of the particular mine, but it was a whole mining area.
It's an area, okay, so it's an area.
And I can't remember how much, but I think about 80% of the exports of Mexico were off the mines in that area. So then the mines were depleted, okay? They drizzled out. Or dribbled out. And so Spratling came into this small community and set up a workshop system. And this was a revolutionary, even though it fit with the Mexican lifestyle, it was a revolutionary concept where he would hire, he had two master silversmiths, and they hired workers, zorritos as they were called, little foxes, who, and so he set up a tier system. Like at first, the little workers would go out and they would get tacos and they would just clean things and buy materials and so forth. But then if they were observant and sharp, like little foxes, then they had the opportunity to hold the blowtorch. The maestro would give them that opportunity.
An apprentice.
Right?
It's a system of apprentices.
Right.
Almost a caste system.
Exactly.
Of workers,
yeah. A very definite caste system.
But not like a Henry Ford production line kind of thing.
No. It's all hand work.
Actual artisans doing the work.
Right.
But you had to earn that right to be an artisan.
Exactly. With the accomplished maestros at the top. And Spratling, who set up the system, was the designer. And his designs were reasonably revolutionary. They were based initially around pre-Columbian designs, and they're very recognizable. Pre-Columbian designs, and then later on, we'll get into that, later on he went into a whole other zone.
And pre-Columbian designs being like Aztec-y type patterns that
yes,
we recognize,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, okay. Stamps. Stamps were the basis of his early designs.
Stamps, I don't understand. I mean,
stamps that the Aztecs or the pre-Columbians used, they were made of ceramic, fired ceramic, cylindrical, and you could roll them across a piece of clay, and it would leave its impression.
Gotcha, they would print with those, right.
They would print something with them.
The geometric patterns,
yes,
really.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So he utilized that in the initial run of his stuff. Now, off Spratling, later on, we got people who left the workshop as accomplished silversmiths. They had come in as zorritos, and then they left, and the first group of those people, the first big shots, were actually Hector Aguilar and Los Castillo.
And they started
and
their
they
own
started
operations.
Their own yeah. operations, right. And again, it was interesting because at this point in time, from let's say 1930 to 1960, Taxco was getting a tremendous amount of play. It was like the center of a whole lot of creative input, and I'm sure you've seen these things happen.
Well,
San Francisco was like that.
Right,
in the
60s, and I'm thinking
right?
of Taos, the Taos Albuquerque.
Yes, same
kind,
sort of
kind
thing.
Of thing for just, Native American jewelry.
These things just come together for who
right.
knows what reasons, but a whole
right.
bunch of things fall together, and all of a sudden you've got a lot
all
of excitement.
All of a sudden, every
here.
Old hippie in blue jeans
yeah,
is there.
Yeah, exactly. So in the case of Taxco, we had movie stars, we had politicians, for instance, Lyndon Johnson, John Kennedy, all the movie stars you
really?
Can name. But we also had the development of a highway, the initial highway that went from Mexico City to Acapulco.
Yeah.
And it went into Taxco.
Yeah.
All right. So that brought us a big deal. Okay. Now the other thing is between 1930 and 1939, the stamps on each one of these workshops were stamping their names on the back of the silver.
And these names, I mean, we see sometimes mm-hmm. it says Mexico, sometimes it says Taxco,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it says 925.
Mm-hmm.
I hope everyone's listening who heard the quiz later earlier. But sometimes there are other numbers too.
Mm-hmm.
And do those, well, I was going to ask if the numbers mean something. Obviously, they do.
They do, yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to get to that, depending upon how much time we have.
Well, this is a one-hour show. Right? Every week we say shortest hour on radio.
On radio, yeah? Okay. So we have between 31, all right, before 1931, this going back to this 1920 to 30 period, when the early primitive tourist jewelry was being made, we only had the mark Mexico silver. Really? That was all that was available. There was no standard of testing whatsoever. When Spratling came in 31, he applied his own mark and guaranteed it at 925 and marked it thusly.
And I want to say that as someone who's taken tons and tons of Mexican silver to the mm-hmm. refiner, we say in our business, Mexican silver, very reliable. Mm-hmm. That assay comes back 925. Frankly, the Mexican gold, not so reliable. The merchandise marked 14 carat will often come back just a bit better than 10 carat. But the 925 sterling Mexican silver usually assays out really
especially
close.
Especially early, the better.
Yeah, I'm sure,
you know?
Yeah.
They were very conscientious, and this is particularly in the days when the designers ran the workshops, okay? They set up their workshops. All right, when we get to the Spratling period, we have 925, and that's the only way we know what we're dealing with,
okay.
And the only way that we are able to identify our maker is if he has his own mark. Between 1931 and 39, that's how we know that the piece dates from that era.
And
puts his name on it.
The name, and not it's not a number mark, it's a name
that's
mark.
That's correct. That's the
And
the
what, early are some, what are some of the names we're looking for?
Well, we're looking for Los Castillo, we're looking for Spratling. In the early days, we're looking for Frederick Davis, who was actually in Mexico City. We're looking for Hector, we're looking for Salvador Terran. Antonio Pineda, who came later, he also, all these guys spun out of the Spratling workshop.
Now again, as someone who handles a lot of this merchandise, I don't see those names very often. So there must be an awful lot of pretenders.
Well, no. I mean, you mean copyists.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean counterfeiters. I mean people who are making merchandise that looks like that style.
Yes, because there were people who worked in those workshops who actually executed those pieces, who are not well known, are certainly not in the top 20,
right.
But they were competent people.
I see.
And so they produced things, sometimes frequently sub rosa. They borrowed stamps, and I'm going to get into another level of stamping here in a second. Maybe we should do that now. And they went out sometimes under other people's marks. So let's wind it out here to 39. We discussed the fact that that Los Castillo and Hector Aguilar were the first people to spin out with their own workshops.
Okay.
Now fast forward to around 1948, and the government. And this was due to, I don't want to get into this story, it's a side story. This was due to tourists going to the border and buying bad silver. The government introduced a assay system. And this assay system was in force from 1948 to 1979. And it was used by all the workshops and all the people that we may discuss in the future and that we've discussed in the past. So, 1948 to 1979, they introduced a hallmark guaranteeing, it's an assay mark actually, guaranteeing the quality of the silver. And this mark is highly stylized, it's a Mexican eagle. But a lot of people in the early days, and this is the one thing that I got incorrect information on, they thought it was a bell mark. And it's frequently referred to today by some of the really old people as a bell mark, okay? But it's actually a stylized Mexican
eagle.
Right. And it will have the number in the center of the chest. In the early days, it had the number in the center of the chest as to which city and which maker owned that mark.
Now I'm starting to realize, I mean, I figured a lot of this stuff was passing through my hands and I didn't recognize it. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to realize I don't see much of this merchandise you're talking about.
Well, that's kind of a big shock for me, because when I got on the highway this in the last couple of years, my specific quest was to pull as much of this stuff out before it went to the smelter as I possibly could, and I'll have to say it's been very disappointing.
People are out there with
no,
you.
No, yeah, they are, but they're not getting anything either.
Hey, Ernie, a little off the subject. You're one of the only guys I know who's totally offline, correct? No computer?
Yeah, no
computer. But you're out there. You see many, many dealers in town. In fact, I talked to a dealer today who said that she just met you. And you're out there talking to people, looking for this merchandise and other types of merchandise, too.
Right.
And then you have other customers who you approach who are looking for this merchandise.
Right.
And you're out there buying and selling every day.
However, I'm not out there. I am out there buying and selling every day, but I'm not out there looking for Mexican silver jewelry. You just can't be out there being specific. You have to have a broad vista on the whole thing to make any kind of money at all.
Yeah, I understand.
And I don't make much.
And so how much of this from this period, this Mexican silver from this period, do you find?
Important pieces, probably a piece every 6 weeks.
Really? I would have just thought.
Not super important.
Because there's so much merchandise coming out of the woodwork with silver over $30.
And a lot of good looking stuff, too. But it's not the right, it's not the kind, as my friend in Chicago would say.
Hey, Ernie, you know, we're just about to go to commercial. I always ask for the last question. What question do you wish we had asked that we didn't? Anything short and sweet you can tell us?
Well, basically, you alluded twice to the number marks or the team or the letter marks, right? So I thought we could cover that. After 1948 to 79 period, the government instituted another method of marking, totally changed, did away with the eagle because there was too much fraud going on.
Anyone could make an eagle.
Yeah. And so they introduced the T system for Tosco, but it was a letter system depending upon the city. Like Mexico City would have an M, Tosco would have a T, and it would say T13, let's say.
Okay, the T13.
T-A-13.
And that is a region then?
No. Oh. Tosco is the T.
Okay.
A is, let's say, the last name of the
designer,
like Aguilar. Yes, Tosco Aguilar, T-A.
Okay.
And then 13 would be the third person in Tosco, the 13th person in Tosco with an A last name who signed the registration list.
So you need a master list of exactly who that refers to.
Exactly.
Interesting. I love it. Hey, Ernie, we're going to take a short commercial break. Then we're going to come back and answer some questions from some emails we've received from some people. I don't know what they are, but we're going to find out during the break. So please don't go away. We're going to be right back on In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and our special guest, Ernie Martin, talking about Mexican silver.
Hi, this is Adam from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio, introducing our weekday James Avery auctions with 1,000 pieces of estate James Avery jewelry sold to the highest bidder with no minimums or reserves. New and retired designs at up to 80% off. This is a perfect opportunity to stock up on hard-to-find pieces. It's easy to register and bid online right now at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Auctions start every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evening at 7 o'clock. Also join us each Saturday at 7 p.m. for our live auctions in Stone Oak, featuring even more designer jewelry from Rolex, Tiffany, Pandora, John Hardy, David Yurman, and more, all guaranteed to be authentic. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Texas license number 16604, member Better Business Bureau. Visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com and join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLUP. James Avery is a registered trademark of James Avery Craftsman Incorporated.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our guest today, Ernie Martin, who has been talking to us and helping us learn about Mexican silver. We do have an email question here about Mexican silver. Where is it? Here it is. Actually, I'm not sure this is really for you, Ernie, but I think it's something I can handle. I know we don't have too much time left, but I'm going to try to squeeze this in. Here's the question. We have several pounds of Mexican coins that have been in my family for a long time, and we keep adding to them. How can I tell if they're valuable? Well, as Ernie was talking about, and we mentioned, there's a lot of silver and gold in Mexico, and all the way back into the 1700s, the Mexican government, under whichever rulers, made all sorts of silver, gold, and even copper, and eventually nickel coinage. Any Mexican coinage from the 1700s and the 1800s should be examined by a numismatist, and you need somebody to tell you what this merchandise might be worth. All of it that's undamaged is rare enough to be of interest to a collector, even though some of it might be only a few dollars. Some of it can be close to priceless, and things from various constitutional and revolutionary era pieces all the way into the 19-teens, as Ernie mentioned, from 1910 to 1920, the revolutionary period. Some of those can be very limited mintage, and we see some very exciting merchandise here in South Texas coming out of Mexico, and not all of it is silver or gold either. In the early to mid 1900s, a lot of the coinage became copper and nickel, and the Mexican government started reducing the silver content of the coins first to 90% to 72% to 50%, all the way down as low as 10%. As silver became more valuable, they just put less and less of it into the coins, until finally, by the 1960s or so, there was almost no silver left. There are only a few silver coins from the 1900s from Mexico that are collectible. Most of them with $30 silver go right to the refiner. The Caballito series, the 1 peso silver dollar coins from 1910 to 1915, always collectible. The 1910 more common, the 1915 less common, but everybody wants the Caballitos. In 1921, Mexico made a silver dos pesos, not the little gold dos pesos. It's the big silver dollar size dos pesos, a beautiful silver coin that's collectible. And also the 5 peso railroad from 1950, always worth more than a silver value, but most of it not gonna be. So bring it, show it to someone, let us, or any qualified numismatist, why do I trip on that word, tell you. Hey, we're out of time. Our thanks to Ernie Martin for joining us, Ernie. We hope to get you back sometime. We're going to be here again next Saturday morning at 7 o'clock with a brand new program. If you have questions about anything, including the meaning of life, email us at questions@inthemoneyradio.com. We'll answer every single question, and the best ones on the air. We hope to see you all tonight at our live auction at the Jewelry Exchange in Stone Oak in San Antonio. And we hope you'll join us again next week for In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Thanks for joining us here this morning. Everybody, please have a great week.